Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Richard Roundtree.
I figure that's an old reference for you. Do you know who that is?
No.
It's the guy who played Shaft.
Oh, yeah.
Also of yes. Shaft's big score and Shaft Goes to Africa.
Yeah, it was definitely
pretty awesome movies.
Watching those movies. As a kid.
You know that Isaac Hayes, he declared bankruptcy shortly after writing that song?
Really?
Yeah. One of my first times in Memphis when I had some time, you know, there was two groups of people in my group, one who went to Graceland and one who went to the Stax Records Museum. I went to the Stax Records Museum. I did subsequently visit Graceland later, and I do think it's great. I'm glad I got to visit both.
I've never been. I would love to go.
I mean, so cool. I was just geeking out over, you know, like, oh, this is the drum kit that is on this Otis Redding song. And like, you know, just the, you know, the actual tape machines. But I didn't realize it at the time because I hadn't known about Isaac Hayes. But in this Stax Museum is his car.
Oh, really? What is
it? Yeah, and I don't remember, like, what it's either a Buick or a Cadillac. You know, it's a big old boat. It's got, like, the trimmed out, you know, the wheels, the whole thing. And to top it off, the cherry on the cake, white fur lining.
Yeah.
Like, the entire thing lined with white fur. I took, like, 100 pictures of it because I was so impressed. And so I don't know if that was pre or post bankruptcy, you know, but
they might have put him there, man.
Yeah, I was sitting in the middle, like on one of those car show carousels, just like cruising around. I was like, oh, man, that's cool.
It's real polar bear fur.
Probably, who knows?
That
it's
was
the 70s,
it.
Baby.
That's what put him out, man. That's what put him over. Yeah. It was the polar bear interior.
Ivory tusk steering wheel or some shit. Yeah. So gangster, though. I loved it. How you doing, Brad?
I'm doing pretty good sitting here in the middle of holiday week, which I guess it's good. It's better than school. If they're not going to go to school, they might as well not have any homework. So
like,
I've got so many projects. I'm not getting anything done, but it's fine. I just had a complete like Nerf gun war in the dark.
Ah, all right.
While the ladies were out doing some shopping. So Oscar and I turned off every light in the house and
yes,
and went for it.
Who won?
He always wins. although I got to say, he came in, we were doing it with like these, like we had agreed to use only like single shot Nerf pistols.
Fair.
He's got some sick stuff.
Oh, what, he could just, yeah, he could just
he's
unload.
He's got some like crazy. So
semi-automatic Nerf.
Yeah. He finally got sick of it and he came marching out with like the automatic freaking
right.
machine gun.
So you guys were like the old West, like one shot, like a standoff.
Yeah, it was like, it was a total standoff. I was basically in surrender mode when he said like, Oscar, what did you say when you came in for a hug before at the end of that Nerf gun battle?
A hug to hug combat.
I love it. I thought he gave you like a Wyatt Earp line, like I'm your Huckleberry or like something like that.
Oh, I was like, oh, all right. That's my
guy. That's pretty good. That's a good way to lose. So, Brad, this is the last episode of 2020, huh?
Yes, it is.
So,
as my wife keeps pointing out, though, she's like, nothing changes just because
I know
the numbers change. She goes,
I actually, yeah, you know how I do this? You know how some, like, 75% of the times I tweet, I like look at it 5 minutes later and I'm like, you're a fucking idiot. And I delete it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That happened just last week where I wrote, can you people spare me like this 2021 escape fantasy? It's starting to drive me fucking crazy. And there is a real psychological disorder where you create escape fantasies. Like you won't save yourself because you keep imagining that there's this like, you know, overwhelming hand or force that's going to come save you.
Right. Right.
That's what it feels like to me. Like this idea that just like at the stroke of midnight, you know, it right. all, I mean, I get the philosophical feeling of it, of just like a restart. Maybe there's a brighter year or something like that. But I mean, it's like, get a fucking grip. Right?
Yeah. This is what I say to her is that, look, you know, you of all people should understand that humans are, you know, of feeble mind and they need these tools, you know.
That's
they
right.
need to, like, we invented time so that we could kind of keep track of shit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yeah. It's basically, yeah, it's an optimistic way of saying, okay, maybe this next allotment of time will be better than the last 12 months.
Whatever. The one last thing I want to get into is that. I have a different question for you. Okay. You've seen a lot of New Year's at this point. You know what?
Oh yeah,
I've seen 74 New Year's. So I know
only six that I can actually remember.
I thought it would be fun for us to each tell a New Year's story of a New Year's memory that stands out, like something super fun or weird or interesting. I have one in mind. Do you want me to go first so you can think of one?
Oh, I've got a few. I'm just trying to think of if I actually if I want to say any of these.
Oscar's in the apartment.
If you're ready, you go first, and I'll
try to
figure out who I might offend.
Well, mine was, so of course you remember in when the turn to the year 2000, everyone had this scare about Y2K. Of course you remember that.
Yeah.
If we have any audience members here who are a little younger, there was a growing theory that every computer code in the world couldn't handle the fact that it was going to be 00 and that apparently everything was going to break down, world economic shutdown, you know, end of the world type shit. Some people were thinking about Y2K. Luckily, I didn't buy it. Actually, an old roommate of mine cleared out a shop vac and made something called Bong 2K out of it, which that's another podcast on its own. But so we didn't buy it too much. And we go down to a New Year's party. And me and one of my best friends, Evan Rich, still one of my best friends, we hatch a plan. We're at our buddy Paul the Captain Hortensio's house in Seaside Park, New Jersey. He's got a little beach house, his parents' beach house. We have access to it for the New Year's. I'm 19 years old at this point. You know, we're getting pretty sauced, as you do on these days. And we hatch a plan. And Evan says, yo, let's cut the power to the house at midnight and just fuck with everybody. Like, make them think that, like, Y2K actually happened.
Nice.
And I'm like, whoa, really? I'm like, and he's much smarter than me. And I'm like, how are we going to do this? He's like, I know exactly how. He's like, you go out and cause a big ruckus, like do what you do, especially at 19.
Right.
I was just a walking tornado, you know? And they're like, yo, he's just like, draw all the attention to you. I'm going to duck out. I'm going to field, like he did like a, you know, field report around the house looking for where circuit breakers were and shit. And he's like, I'm going to duck out right when it hits zero. I'm going to pull it. And you like play it up, you know? So we did exactly that. Like maybe a couple minutes before, I'm getting everyone's attention. I'm like, here we go, blah, 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 countdown. Who's got drinks? Blah, blah, blah. You know, drawing everyone. Evan just ducks out because he's super sleuth. And it goes like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And just shuts like the entire main breaker to the house, you know? So everything zaps off. And people are like, Yo, straight panicking. I'm serious. There were some people like, oh my God. Oh my God. It's actually happening. Oh my God. Oh my God. What are we going to do? Blah, 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 blah. And a couple people were just like, this isn't right, you know? And then, before people started realizing that there's streetlights on outside and stuff. And then, but the best part of all this is my buddy Parker walks up. The most punk rock thing I've maybe ever seen, which was, he comes up to everybody. He's like, yes, yes, it happened. Fuck yeah. This is awesome.
Anarchy.
Oh my God. He was so stoked for the fall of civilization. And he might be one of the most like Cro-Magnon people I know who like would survive if it came down to like stone tools again. Like he'd actually be right up his alley.
Nice.
And then, yeah, eventually someone like was like, wait, there's a streetlight on. Why is Benny laughing? You know, Evan pops out of the closet. People start picking up on it. But we did pull one of the great hoaxes of New Year's history and convince people that Y2K happened.
I love it. I love that story because that is something that I would have loved to have been a part of.
What do you think? You think you would have been into it?
Oh, fuck yeah, dude. Well, I would have been in. I would have. That's an idea that I would have come up with. I would.
Right.
I love a good, relevant, and hard to execute prank.
Yeah. So yeah. Yeah. You would have hatched it. Yeah. You know how to make bonfires and stuff. I'm sure you would have.
Hell yeah, dude. I figure out how to fake it just so nicely.
All right, hit me with yours because I'm picturing like you and Lieutenant Dan and Forrest Gump in like Times Square in 1971 or something.
Oh, what no. Is it actually? I've actually only ever been anywhere near Times Square once. And we didn't even get within a few blocks and ended up coming across some dude with like a knife wound and had to take him to the emergency room.
Oh, good.
That was my only Times Square story. But I do have some right. One or two New Year's
give
stories.
Give me the top. Give me
which
the
I'm
top.
I'm not going to talk about in public, including my 2001, which I'd be glad to tell you personally at some point.
Okay, this is an entertainment.
But I do have one that I was recently reminded of. It's very New York.
Okay.
Kind of an endless New York story. Ooh. So, and you might know this place.
Like a Woody Allen movie.
There's this little bar on Houston Street called Milano's, which is a real classic hole in the wall. It's like one of those long, narrow bars, you know, barely fits like 30 people tops, right?
Love it.
It's been there since I moved to New York in the late 80s. And it's been exactly the same. And like every few years, you know, the latest generation of hipsters kind of discovers it. And like, you know, they might pop in or meet somebody for a drink. It's never really become a like hipster hangout. And it's always the kind of place that you can go by at 9 o'clock and it's got a couple old alkies in there drinking.
Perfect.
And anytime you go in, there's going to be a 70-year-old dude like at the bar with his head on it.
Right,
to this day, it blows my mind, you know. So
I
like, and
right.
I, you know, we discovered it back when I was, you know, when I was a ute and first moved here,
sure.
And we would go there for drinks, you know, and like it was a good meeting place because it's only a couple blocks from like Broadway on Houston, anyway, and it's still there and it's still exactly the same. Like I can't believe it, but this was a New Year's Eve. It must have been the mid or early 90s. It was pre cell phone for sure because I was trying to hook up with a bunch of friends, including my girlfriend, and I was using the payphone at Milano's. I was trying to hook up with them. So I'm sitting in the back of Milano's. It's New Year's Eve. I couldn't connect. I called them. I said, call me back at this number.
Back in the day when it was so easy to get lost in New York City.
And like their payphone was their house phone, you know, like it was a classic bar. So like, So like they could actually call me back on the payphone.
Okay.
And I'm waiting. I get a beer. I finish the beer. There's literally two old men sitting at the bar, one of them with his head on the bar. Next thing I know, it's midnight. I got there at maybe 11:30. It wasn't like I was there for a long time. I got there like 11:30 thinking like, I'm going to call these guys. I'll find out where they are.
Yeah, right.
And for whatever reason, it took them longer to get back to me. So I happened to be in Milano's at the stroke of midnight. And like it probably was like 5 after midnight because the bartender is over like kind of wiping off glasses. He looks up, he goes, oh, hey, New Year's, guys. Happy New Year's. And the no shit. It was like a movie. The drunk on the bar lifts his head off the bar, raises his glass. It says, Happy New Year. Takes a sip and puts his head back down.
Yes.
So that was my most memorable New Year's in New York with three strangers, all like probably over the age of 70.
It's super, like, amazingly anticlimactic.
But the good news is I did eventually get through to my girlfriend and her friends. And as every New Yorker knows, like, that's, you know, midnight is basically the start of New Year's Eve in New York City.
Right, sure. Yeah, it goes long. It goes long. Oh, man. I imagine for some reason when you said the New York story, I imagine that one of the two guys at the bar was going to be like Robert De Niro or like Anthony Bourdain or like something weird like that. It was just there. It was like, yeah, Happy New Year's.
No, but I think Milano's is the kind of place that has that history.
Yeah, that's like, what I was thinking. Like,
it's really rinky dink and it's still a total dive. It's managed to never be completely taken over by hipsters. So
yeah. I wonder what people in Arizona do for New Year's.
They go to baseball games.
Wait, during New Year? I don't. You're such a nerd. There's no baseball now. Come on, Brad.
But it's like the summertime down there, right? Because it's the south side of the planet.
I did just hear, you know, 2020 was again like the hottest year on record. It tied 2016. And one of the stats that stood out to me was the Phoenix area apparently had 185 days. That was over 100.
Holy shit.
Which I'm just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that's kind of, that's some end time shit there. Ouch.
But I get a vibe, you know, what a chill guy.
Oh, dude. Yeah.
What a chill guy Zach was. And I love talking to somebody from the desert, you know, they just have a vibe.
You like talking to a drummer. Come on, admit it.
I thought we didn't go too heavy on drums.
Yeah, you went heavier on sports than drums.
Yeah, a little bit, not too much.
Listen, No.
These are your biggest nightmare podcasts when there's like a drummer who's into sports on. You're like, oh no, I'm not gonna get to talk about tone. No, once
it's you're right, it's the, it nothing is not, it doesn't get boring in any aspect.
Nah, I thought we kept it good. And I actually even didn't get to drop a tidbit. Apparently Zach's dad, you know, actually had a cup of coffee up in the major leagues and was a professional baseball player for a minute, but was blocked by Robin Yount, who wound up being, you know, like a 3,000 hit Hall of Fame player. So if you're going to get blocked or, you know, by a player coming up, you know, it's sort of a claim to fame to be like, you know what? I was behind Robin Yount in the depth chart. It's like, what the fuck are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know?
There's not much to say there.
Yeah, not much to say there. But this was a fun interview. Thanks for joining us just before New Year's.
Yeah.
I hope you do some sexy time stuff tonight. Some champagne hot tubs, bearskin rugs, fake bearskin rugs. Yeah, I don't know. We should listen to this interview.
Let's do it.
What's up, Benny? What's up, Brad?
Chilling. We've met before at festivals, I believe, right?
Yeah, we played together. I think a handful of times. I think we even, you did some dates in New Jersey and Philly. I think we opened up for you guys.
That's right. Funky couple days for me, I'm afraid. But it was awesome that you guys played. So do you like my name, Craig Council?
I was like a little bit confused. That's an obscure like D-back. It's funny. He was like always way more popular than he was talented.
Yeah.
You know, he was a gritty player. Like people in Phoenix seem to like those guys.
I'm sure. That's kind of where my head was going. I was like, well, because obviously, you know, the 2001 Diamondbacks are a pretty pivotal team in my sports history because of the obvious.
Sure.
And I was trying to think of like the coolest deep cut player on the 2001 Diamondbacks for you. But then I also knew your dad was an infielder. So I kind of started putting it together that maybe a gritty infielder like Craig Council would be your type of guy.
Yeah, he was a good player. You know, Tony Womack, I think, was on that team.
Yeah, sure.
I believe. There's some, you know, the D-backs have a long history of sort of like the gritty underdog player. You know, there's a few that come to mind. But yeah, that, you know, I think those are always like the fan favorites here.
Is it hard for you to reconcile your Kurt Schilling fandom?
I'm not really a fan of Kurt Schilling. I mean, you know, like I don't have a hard time. I mean, I'm not really a fan of the kind of guy he is or whatever, but right. I think political opinions from sports, people who are really good at sports, it doesn't really bother me. You know, it's like, I'm not asking the guy who's cooking my barbecue in the South what he thinks about Trump. I'm just, right. I'm just eating the fucking food, you know, like, and so there's a sort of element to like, if someone's really good at what they do and you can appreciate that, you can't expect them to be, you know, like, I don't know, like, take Tom Brady, for instance, like maybe he's a Trump supporter, maybe he's not, whatever. It doesn't really matter, but it's like, he's so good in one area of his life that you can kind of forgive the other areas where, if, you know, they may have shortcomings.
I can see that. I mean, you can't always be looking at your athletes as moral compasses. That's a fact.
Sure.
So, but when, I mean, I guess there's got to be a line at some point, you know, like there's been some athletes who have been so disgusting in their personal lives that I've had to like make a choice, you know, like I can no longer support this player.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, like, and I think Kurt Schilling is just kind of, even beyond his political opinions, just not a very good person, I don't think. Yeah. So like, it's like easy to, yeah, dude. Exactly. So I think that, you know, there's probably a lot of sports guys or people in the sports world who I have totally different opinions.
Sure.
Then politically, but they're nice dudes, you know, like when push comes to shove, like they're not like horrible human beings. So
yeah.
And we have to make space for that. But and I can appreciate like what they do on the field. But you know, like it does, yeah, you're right. It gets to a point where like, okay, time out on this guy, you know, even if he is like the reason why we have our one like right. championship in the city, or one yeah. of the reasons why we have a championship in the city, then, you know, but yeah, at some point there are always like, you know, it's okay to set boundaries.
Sure. Well, it's always fraught with inconsistency too, because it's like, you know, people would want to vilify someone like that for just kind of being like, dude, you don't like his opinion. You know what I mean? Like, which I don't. I find his opinion ugly and weird. But it's like no surprise, you know, if you put that many hundreds of people from different places into the same environment, like certain guys who come from certain places are probably going to have that opinion. Like, do you remember when people went crazy about the guy from Duck Dynasty saying some like, you know, borderline? I'm like, what the fuck? What'd you think? What'd you think Duck Dynasty yeah. guy was going to do, you know? And then
yeah.
people will go crazy about that. But then I watch these, like, you know, I've watched Aroldis Chapman on my team for the last 2 years, who, you know, basically beat his girlfriend and shot a gun into a couch. You know, everybody's like, oh, keep throwing 102. And, you know, we don't really care so much. So,
yeah,
it's always fraught with inconsistency when you see, once you start going down that road, right?
Sure, absolutely. You know, and the other thing is that there's kind of, you know, like, I think when you're in the art world, it's in a weird way, like we oftentimes like to think that we just, you know, we scour the landscape for the correct political opinion on this thing, or the correct way to, you know, be in this certain area of life. And we all think we come to these understandings without like a context that we're in, you know. And mm-hmm. I like, just being in a band and being around people who created art and created music, and going on tour and being in a van and kind of relying on people, you know, before we were making really any money on the road. I think I started to learn, and to my eyes were opened up, because I was raised really conservatively. So like mm-hmm. politically, religiously. And, you know, all of a sudden I find myself in this community of people right. where I'm kind of rewarded for thinking something or looking at the world differently than how I was brought up. Mm. And I think in the sports world, you know, a lot of these guys were raised in an environment where a lot of more sort of traditional opinions, I guess I'll use the word traditional, but, you know, opinions about life and maybe conservative politics and, you know, gender roles and, you know, if it's okay to be gay or not. Like, a lot of these guys are raised in an environment where, in the sports world, where that's kind of normalized, you know? And so I think that depending on where you find yourself in life, it is sort of, you end up kind of adopting, you know, if I were to come out and say something really, you know, not PC, right? Like, I'd be, a lot of people would be disappointed because I found a community with people who have a shared vision.
I
find that a lot. Like, in sports, we kind of have to sort of take that into consideration. Like, these guys come from a world where, you know, these ideas and this way of looking at the world is kind of the norm. And, like, you know, you're not going to find a lot of, like, you know, minor league baseball players with Bernie stickers on their car. You know, you're just not going to see it.
But in the same way, you know, it's interesting because in the same way that you, you know, like you said, you were raised in a conservative household and then got out on the road and were exposed to these things. But you were open to them and you understood the landscape and you were able to adapt. You know, a lot of these athletes wind up in situations early on where they're on teams with people from all over the place, all over the world, especially baseball players, you know, like, and if you're 10 years into baseball and you're still a racist or anti-immigrant or something, like, you've had plenty of exposure to Hispanic people, you know, you've had plenty of exposure to that and you still decided, you know, to make that delineation. So I always have a hard time reconciling that stuff. Like when and where you draw the line with athletes, it's like, I used to fight people all the time on the idea that, hey, Screwdriver wrote great songs. And I'm like, well, listen, I can't listen to Screwdriver because, you know, they probably want, like, me and my family dead. So I've been able to make that delineation with music. And it's like this overwhelming sports fandom. It's like, it's so big that even though, you know, like, one of these guys is a piece of shit, you kind of still, it's like a little harder to pull back like your fandom, you know?
Yeah. Cause he's like our piece of shit, you know, like he's on our team. Yeah. And so it's easier to justify it. You know? Yeah. I mean, you know, like, you know, I can't listen to Michael Jackson anymore, you know? And like, yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, and that's a bummer because like you can observe, you know, the songwriting skill of Screwdriver. I mean, like, objectively, Michael Jackson was a musical genius and just an entertainment genius in general. But yeah, I mean, I can't, like, there is sometimes a point in time where you have to say, okay, I just can't, like, even throw this dude's, even though he's dead and gone, I'm not going to throw this dude's estate, like, the half a cent that I'm going to get from listening to a song on Spotify, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's tricky. I feel like, you know, this is something we talk a lot about on the podcast, especially these days, is like, you know, cancel culture and who deserves to be put down and who deserves redemption and why. And like, you know, and, you know, how much do you forgive like the trespasses of the past and stuff like that? And I think everybody's been kind of coming to terms with where they sit on that, you know, in the last couple of years. Like you follow sports so closely, you know, how many instances have come out in the last couple of years of a kid getting drafted into like the NFL or the MLB? And then they dig up some tweet from when they were like 14 years old saying like the dumbest shit. You know, I don't care about that. I truly, you know what I mean? Like, I've made the decision that like, if I had Twitter when I was 14 years old, and this culture existed, I probably would have been fucking canceled. I would have said some crazy ass shit, you know, like, you know, about burning American flags or like throwing white people in an ocean, like the way I was when I was like a 14-year-old punk, you know, I would have been canceled in a second. So you got to, where do you draw the line, Zach?
I think that's a good question. I think for me, like, yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, like, for instance, the Coyotes just drafted a guy who wasn't just even the, his first, I think he was the first round pick. And I forget his name, but the Arizona Coyotes drafted him. And like immediately he had a history of bullying another kid in his, in his grade. And when they looked into it, I think what kind of sunk this guy wasn't necessarily that he did what he did when he was in high school. It was sort of his reaction to it in the present and almost kind of like, you know, and not necessarily owning and acknowledging, hey, yeah, what I did was fucked up. And
he's like,
you
know, down.
Yeah. Kind of like not really, you know, saying the right things and, or expressing remorse. And so I think for me, it's like the, you know, if it's something where someone is routinely like Ryan Adams, for instance, right? The singer songwriter, like, you know, he had a routine behavior of targeting people and putting, you know, and taking advantage of people and using his position. That to me is like, okay, that crosses the line because it's like not just a mistake you make in like a tweet or whatever. It's like you're sort of you're making a habit of something.
Right.
And to me, that's a big, you know, people can make mistakes. I say dumb stuff online all the time. Right. You know, and you can cancel me and not listen to whatever, but I get that. But like, if I've done something to hurt someone and then I'm like, oh, well that was cool, I'm going to do that again.
Right.
Then I think that's kind of where we draw the line.
Yeah, so I mean, so much of it's just that personal decision about, I guess, when you decide somebody actually learned from their mistakes. It was kind of Louis C.K.'s problem, right? Like, he may have had a path back if he handled that in a different way and took things on in a different way, but he sort of doubled down, and now nobody wants anything to do with him.
It's really interesting. It's a good point, you know, like, I think people are, you know, especially in the U.S., I think people are really pretty open to people being like, hey, I fucked up and I shouldn't have done any of that stuff. And, you know, and just kind of the only thing that can kind of back them up going forward is just how they behave and how they frame what it is they've done and what they're standing behind, in what they've done. And if you can't even just do that, then it's sort of like, I think there's maybe some sort of, I think guys like Louis C.K. and a lot of entertainers and sports people have like a dysmorphia when it comes to, hey, like, yeah, you're a big deal. People really like what you do and you're super talented, but you also are like accountable,
right?
To act a certain way, just like anyone else. And just because you think you're hot shit or whatever doesn't really give you a pass or make it okay, you know?
There's one other path. There's the Kobe Bryant path, which is pay it off and deliver three more rings and no one will ever talk about it again. that's the real America right there.
You know, that's a valid point, a very valid point.
Rings makes everyone forget. Bring the city a ring. We didn't see anything. I wanted to talk about something I was listening to an interview with you about where, again, like we noted, you came from a more conservative background, but you were taken every summer to where your father was playing baseball. And apparently in some sort of way, your exposure to the parks and the people and the music you were hearing there kind of connected you in a way to rock and roll, right? Because you weren't really allowed to access it at home. Is that right?
Yeah. That's pretty much right. I mean, yeah, I think that there's kind of like this juxtaposition being raised in a pretty like conservative religious background and then spending time in a minor league ballpark.
Right.
And not only spending time with people at the park, but also players, you know, just kind of, you're sort of exposed to this adult world that even as a kid, like I'm the coach's kid and they probably are annoyed by me, annoyed that I'm around, but right, what are they going to do? Like in the minor leagues, I feel like players don't really have a whole lot of say of what's going on. And, So I, you know, in a weird way, like my brother and I were bat boys and just worked at the park or did whatever and was around the team all the time. And, you know, it's definitely like an exposure, I feel like, to like the real world and not this sort of like, you know, kind of religiously sealed off bubble that we were in the other, other times when we weren't on the, out with my dad. So,
right.
And then, yeah. And then just hearing the music, you know, like just when their teams are taking BP or, you know, even in between innings. And like, I remember it's funny. There was like, this group of relievers on my dad was managing a double A team for the Reds in Vermont.
Okay.
Called the Vermont Reds in Burlington. And nice. My dad had a handful of guys in the bullpen who were kind of like these, you know, minor league wild reliever characters, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
And so they convinced my dad that they wanted to do like air guitar during the seventh, like in the seventh inning stretch to, Scorpions, yes. Rock Me Like a Hurricane.
Of
right.
Of course. Yes.
And so they, you know, I remember when back in the day when, players would play, they'd have like the sanitary socks, like the like really thin white socks, you know, that weren't even socks. They were just kind of like, they would wear the actual stirrups over these socks.
I see.
Well, they put those over their face like masks. and then they got bats and they just basically did air guitar to the Scorpions. And I just thought, this is so strange. Like this shit was so not fly at my house, but like, you know, these players are doing it. And it was just funny. And like, and as a kid, I'm thinking, man, that song sounds really cool. Like, what is that?
Right.
And so, for sure, that was a big aspect of, just learning about music in a lot of ways.
So I'm just envisioning in my head, like these three relievers, they kind of all look like the power hitter on the Yankees from Major League, right? Like, did they all have mullets? What was the vibe of these guys?
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to remember their names. I think there was one guy named, his name is Mike Condor, which is such a funny name.
Oh, that's perfect.
And yeah, like I think one of the guy had like a perm. And then one dude, they were all basically kind of the more rough around the edges type players. And it's funny because like my dad, he managed Norm Charlton, he managed Rob Dibble, in the minor leagues,
wow,
and had
really?
A lot had a lot of those like young Reds guys. That, you know, it's crazy on that team. Paul O'Neill was on that team. Chris Sabo, Barry Larkin.
No shit.
They
Little Eric Davis, maybe.
Yeah, I think Eric Davis was already in the big leagues at that point.
Yeah, he was like straight up. Yeah,
but my dad had a really good team. He won the Eastern League Championship 2 years in a row. And it's funny because in the Burlington had a celebration for the team, and at the time Bernie Sanders was the mayor of Burlington. So like when they had the big party for the team winning their championship, my dad got to meet Bernie Sanders.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's old school.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
So listen, Mike Condor does exist. And get this, he's in the William Patterson University Baseball Hall of Fame, which is in New Jersey. So I think your boy, Mike Condor, was an old Jersey boy, graduated in 1977. This adds up.
I cannot believe I remember that name right.
Yeah, it looks like you're a catcher. He says he was a catcher, but that was in college. So he might have switched by the time he got to the pros.
Yeah, but that's funny. Yeah, I don't know. It's something, you know, it might have been, it could have been Mike Condorla.
Okay.
So I don't know. But we'll have to, something along those lines. I don't remember, but I'm drawing a blank on some of the names.
It's really funny though. And do you like, besides for that Scorpion song, like I was wondering, you know, it said you were going every summer where your dad was and doing a lot of traveling. And I know, or I just would imagine like a minor league situation. You're not, you know, staying in 5-star hotels or traveling in a certain way. Do you think doing that when you were a kid kind of set you up for touring at all? Like you think you're really ready to hit the road when the time came and a little less freaked out by it maybe because of your background?
Yeah, I think that that had, I think it definitely an impact on me. Like just seeing, like traveling in the, like in the minor league bus from town to town.
Right.
I've taken the minor league bus and slept up on the luggage racks in between. You know, so yeah, I think that definitely kind of got me prepared for it. Just kind of experience, you know, I think the other thing that really kind of helped me and understand the grind of it, you know, like what the players right. would have to go through emotionally, physically, what they'd be, you know, they're chasing just getting to that next level. You know, they just want to get to the next level. They're working their ass off and they're working it, they're working really hard in circumstances that aren't glamorous, you know? And, I think that definitely had an impact on me for sure.
And when you're doing like the touring for like Static Prevails, are you in your head being like, all right, we're single A right now, but you know, we're working our way up.
I didn't make the direct comparison. you know, at the time I was like, this is rad. Like we're on tour.
Right. And, yeah.
So there was a kind of like naivete that we had. And I think kind of you can only have when you're that young and just stoked to be out doing something and playing show, even though the shows were like piss poorly attended. Of course, maybe the sound guy was there, maybe a bartender's buddy was there. That was kind of it.
That's amazing. So what's going on with you at home? You're in Mesa, Arizona, right?
So I grew up in Mesa. I live in Phoenix, which is just like just kind of two towns over.
Sure.
It's kind of the big area. It's all kind of the same metropolitan area, but living in Phoenix and waiting to do some touring.
Yeah, so what's your day-to-day been like the last few months? I know you got some kids and so how are you setting up your day? What's your routine like?
Well, you know, we're just don't have too much of a routine. We're like Arizona's been a really kind of a hotspot for most of from basically middle of June on. And we had a little bit of an improvement in the fall and did a little bit of flag football coaching.
Oh, cool.
And when things were better, and you know, the band's been busy. We've been like rehearsing and practicing for like the last 3 months. So mostly it would be getting up and kind of hanging out with the kids, getting the kids ready for school, and then heading out to the studio and working and then coming home. But we just wrapped finishing. We filmed three concert films.
Right. And that's the Phoenix Sessions?
Yeah, that's the Phoenix Sessions. Right. So, and we just sort of wrapped that up. And now that that's done, like the schedule is a little more different. We're not going down to the studio quite as much. And, you know, just trying to be around and available for, you know, the family life, being, you know, trying to be in dad mode.
Sure. Do you guys own a space in Phoenix? How do you guys get together and practice?
So we rented the same little sort of warehouse space in Tempe for the past, I don't know, almost 20 years now.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
That must be like a second home, pretty lived in.
It's very lived in. It's a total fucking wreck and it's a disaster, but it's great. I mean, it works. We, you know, it sounds really good there. We can rehearse, we can write, we can do everything we need to do there. And it's just been a nice place to have, like a home base.
And how far from your home is it?
It's like 15 minutes. Not bad.
I feel like everything in Phoenix, Tempe, or Mesa is always 15 minutes away. Every time I've been there.
It's kind of like that, you know, unless you're going like, you know, we kind of picked the spot so that it would be central to the valley. And like Tempe is positioned as kind of the center point. ASU is kind of right in the middle of the entire valley. And we have some guys who live, you know, kind of more south of Phoenix. And then Jim and I live in Phoenix, so we kind of meet in the middle.
That's awesome. Now, I want to ask some background to your drumming, because, I mean, I don't know if I managed to stick my nose up your ass when I met you at festivals, but you know, you were an influence on my own drumming. And something cool has happened in the last few years, which is my lovely niece, Thea, has also become a drummer and a pretty big fan of your drumming. So,
oh, nice. That's cool.
Brad, are we queued up for this? Can you hook me up here?
I think we can make it happen.
All right. So, Zach, this is from my beloved niece.
I'm Thea Horowitz. I'm 12 and in seventh grade, and I've been playing drums for about 4 years. What kind of drumming were you doing when you were around 12 years old?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, hi, nice to meet you. Nice to hear your voice. Not really meet you, but nice to hear your voice. So when I was 12, I had been drumming for probably a little bit less than you. I think you probably started earlier than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I think, in the seventh grade as well. In that seventh grade window, I was really not playing in bands at all. I was learning how to play drum set, and I was playing in the school band.
Okay.
And I was also, I started playing in the jazz band at school. And it's funny because even then, when I was that young, Jim, our singer from Jimmy Eat World, he and I were friends and went to the same middle school. And Jim and I actually went to preschool together, so we knew each other from that long ago. Yeah, but he would bring his guitar. He would bring over his Ibanez and create half stack.
Okay,
and we would rip it up in my room, playing, like, you know, muddling our way through like various Metallica sections of songs.
Yes.
And so, you know, kind of figuring it out and learning things. You know, by that time I could kind of listen to more music and, was sort of getting really into U2. So I was like learning U2 songs and, but mostly I was like practicing a lot in my bedroom on my drum set. I took, lessons. My really good teacher, I think, I stopped taking lessons from him then. Because he went off to college. Okay. And so, yeah, I was just kind of really digging in, learning drum set, but also playing in the school band and playing drum set in the school jazz band.
And then just jamming with Jim. Was Jim like, was he like a ripper already? Was he kind of like a little rock and roll kid, or?
Jim was a ripper, man. Like from like, you know, he would, that's when he was like bringing over VHS tapes of like Yngwie Malmsteen.
Yes.
And, Jim is also kind of like, he would show me music that I didn't even have access to.
Right.
Like I remember, he brought over to my house one time this like VHS of Ministry playing, and blew my mind.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's like the Ministry concert where they have like the chain link fence up, and yeah, like I was just like, whoa, that's scary. I do not want to go there.
Terrifying show, yeah.
But so Jim was always kind of a little bit more, I think, in the know than I was. He was definitely more of like a I think devourer of all things music and always finding like obscure things to show me. But he was always an amazing, I think he took lessons young. He started very young.
Okay.
And has always been just like by far the best at his instrument of anyone in our band. And it's not close.
Right. So he kind of led you all down the dark path a little bit.
Sort of, kind of. I mean, like a little bit. By the time we started playing in the Jimmy World, we maybe a little bit less so, you know. But definitely, like he. I think the thing that we've never lost is like we're always like, even now we think about it. We're kind of like just. We always have that like Metallica, Master of Puppets and Justice for All, like kid inside of us that wants to, like, you know, that sort of secretly wishes like we were in that band. But
you definitely hear the riffs every once in a while. Cause every once in a while, I listen to Jimmy World, I'm like, that's a pretty fucking metal riff. you know?
Exactly. We do have a little, like metal kid deep inside of us somewhere.
We all do.
So I think there was kind of a part two to this question. You may have actually addressed it.
What was your first band called and who was in it? Also, what age were you when you started your first band?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a really good question.
Thea, love you, Thea. These are great, great questions. You're the best.
Very good. Yeah, she needs to get her own podcast.
And this space is getting a little crowded, Zach. I don't know if you know that. You know, hey, Thea, back up. Maybe do something else, sweetheart, okay?
So I think it was my sophomore year in high school is when I kind of started playing in my first band. I met a guy in high school. He was a senior and I was a sophomore and his name was Kevin Lane. Mm-hmm. And, then there was another guy and I forget his name. I want to say his name is Theo or something like that. And we started a band and we, brought in a guy named Trey, who I'm still friends with today. And he was our bass player, amazing bass player. And we were called No Longer Plaid. So I was probably, 16, 17, something around there.
Was that like a post-ska, anti-ska kind of reference?
No, I don't know what the name came from. We were very much like, a sort of punk rock version of REM.
Oh, okay. It's fun.
Yeah.
The name works for that.
Yep.
And how long did that last for?
That didn't last long.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think at some point we added I had that band kind of like splintered off and disintegrated a little bit, and then I brought Tom in.
Mm, okay.
To play with me, because I met Tom through those guys. We started playing with me and Trey and Tom, and Kevin would play together. And then that kind of our bass player Trey, who's a really good bass player, left our band for Greener Pastures. We're like a band that was actually like gigging and you know. And so then that sort of left us in a position where Tom and I were just kind of like, well, what do we do now?
Right.
And so I said, well, let's give Jim a call. Jim was already playing in another band, but like, hey, let's see if he wants to join and he can just do double duty. And that's kind of how Jimmy World started.
So it really formed like towards the end of high school like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, cool. Senior year was when we really, middle of senior year.
Well, you mentioned U2 before, which was an interesting reference. Cause I mean, I know even though they were an influence for you musically, you know, one of the things that always stands out about Jimmy Eat World to me is like, you know, your longevity and the way you guys operate your business, cutting it up equally, which is something U2 does too. And I know a lot of bands have tried to do what you all have done, you know, essentially just longevity with the same unit of people and consistently good albums and music through the years. So what's the formula? What's your tricks?
What's the secret?
You know, like a lot of people want to know like what you found, because it's one of the more impossible tasks I've seen a band do, especially an American band. What's been some tools for you all to make that happen? How do you communicate with each other? You know, what are some insights on how that operates?
Man, that's a good question. You know, I think it's a funny question for us because it's like we see it from the other way around. Our sort of response is like, how do you fuck this up? You know, like, right. You know, yeah, like what's the,
sure.
And I'm sure that there's a lot of, you know, we're lucky. I think, first of all, I think we've been really lucky. I think that's the biggest factor. Second of all, I think like, how things start makes a big difference. And the way we started was just like, hey, we're four guys having fun in a garage. And, like we set small goals. So like our first goal, like in the garage, like, hey, let's open up, let's play a show or open up for somebody. Right. Mm-hmm. And then we just do that. And like, oh, it would be cool to do like a recording and just let's do a recording. So we just always on to the next thing of like, okay, what's the next goal? And like, and then we'd start like, we started getting to the point in our local market where we were making relationships with promoters where like, let's say Sebado was coming through. We'd be like, hey, we want to open up for Sebado. Like, let us open up. And so we were big enough to where they'd let us come and open up and we could be like a local opener. We got to open up for Rancid and got to open up for, you know, a bunch of different bands that came through. And so just do that. And, you know, I think in the long run, I think it's really looking at it as a unit, looking at it as everyone has a contribution. And I think a lot of mistakes that people make in bands and, you know, even, you know, it's like, you can't always look at what different band members contribute to a band in terms of like just pure workload or measuring it in certain ways. Like that gets, I think, a lot of bands tripped up.
Right.
You know, we don't really look at it that way. I think we, you know, in some ways you can look at, like for instance, a really good example of this is, you know, Rick is an awesome bass player and an even better dude.
Right.
And, you know, and Rick is like an enthusiast, right? And if you come up with an idea, Rick will be like, oh man, that idea sounds awesome. Let's do it.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people, when they're not in a relationship with like a collective of four guys, a lot of people wouldn't necessarily look at like what Rick's doing as like a role in the band.
Right.
But it's like, that's almost as important as like the dude who's like, hey, you know, let's go do this, and then we're going to do this after that, and then we're going to play this song, and then we're going to make this record, and then we're going to go on tour. Like, you kind of need a balance of that. And the cool thing about that is we respect each other to where, like, when Rick says, hey, you know what? That doesn't sound like the best idea.
Right.
Like, it means a lot. It's like, okay, if Rick's antenna is going up, is like, that's not a very good idea.
Yeah, because he's so consistently stoked that.
It's like, and so I just think, like, the fact that, A, we give each other space to be who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And we also respect each other to recognize, like, in a lot of ways, like I just will run my mouth and say, we need to do this. And I'll like get on someone or I'll, you know, I'm like the sort of alpha male in the band.
Right. Yeah.
And these guys let me be me, you know, and they're really patient with me. Right. Yeah, and over time, what I've realized is I realize more and more, they're being really patient with me, you know, and as I get older, like, right. You know, I think, man, I could let the gas off the pedal a little bit and make more room and give other people a space to, you know, like create a vacuum so that they feel comfortable filling it.
Mm.
And so I just think over time we've kind of learned that we trust each other, we respect each other. And like there's hardly ever really like major, like, volatile disagreements, hardly ever.
So
and
cool.
I would also say a huge, huge part of it is Jim.
Right.
Jim is just a unique dude. You will not find very many front men or guys who are, you know, like without a doubt, like, you know, when we're like, if you think of us as like a Peloton, right? Jim is the lead writer in the Peloton.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And we're drafting off of him creatively in a lot of ways. And so I think us recognizing that, and then us saying, hey, when can we spell him? Or when can we say, hey, Jim, we don't need to worry about this stage, you know, let, you know, Tom or Zach or Rick take the lead and like, you know, we're there to protect him from burning out or whatever.
Mm.
And so I think that's kind of a good analogy for us is, you know, that Jim is in that role as that lead writer in the Peloton, but he really does truly interact and give everyone space in the band to be them. be themselves and to not freak out about what all of our limitations might be, or, you know, and I've always felt like that's the key. If you have a front person who is not there to serve like the group, you know,
right.
and not understand that, like, hey, that the extra maybe work that you do, in some ways, like, you can benefit from that. Right. So like, you're building a benefit, but you may not be seeing it like in the dollars and cents. You know, like, for instance, it's like if Jimmy World blows up and we never do anything again, like, it's going to be a lot easier for Jim to like have a career in music and more successful than it would be for me. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, you know, but at the same time, like, how things start matters. And like, you know, when we first started, like, Jim was just kind of like, okay, we're going to bring Jim in as like, you know, this extra dude we need. You know, Tom was our singer.
Yeah,
Tom was our front guy.
Sure.
And
he was the singer on what, like, half of Static Prevails, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, and then over a course of time, like, we just sort of saw, like, wow, Jim is just like,
yeah, right.
If you go, I think you can listen to our first demos on YouTube where Jim is singing his first songs, and, you know, and then you listen to what he's doing now, and it's like, the difference is astronomical.
Sure.
And like, you know, and he's such a fantastic performer, singer, and artist all the way through that, you know, and that just sort of happened over the course of time within the life of the band. And it's been fun to see, but, you know, I think it's just sort of helped us be centered and, I think we just operate like an equal, like sort of a democracy.
Yeah. Super cool. I love that. I don't know if you've ever considered this element of it, but I was reading an interview where, you know, all four of you come from families that are still together. Have you ever considered like maybe sociologically, like, your mindset are people who kind of know how to stick through things that are difficult and not bail, like, potentially maybe because of like the solid, like, family foundations you had? Not to say there are no problems in a couple who's still together can present its own problems in a million ways. But as far as just like not running away from something that's hard and actually seeing your way through it. Does that example maybe played a role, you think?
I think that probably has some sort of difference. I think it might have something to it. I think it has a lot more to do with just the personality mix that we have.
Right.
But I think that, you know, I think our personalities are probably formed a lot by that stability growing up.
Sure,
and, you know, like, it's easier, I think, to maybe have that if you grow up in a home where maybe your parents had a contentious relationship and they didn't make it. And, you know, and that there's a sort of like volatility in that relationship. It might make it harder to trust people. And so I think that might play a part, but, you know, I think it's a combination of luck, a mixture of our personalities, and like the fact that, you know, we've been able to achieve some financial success that has allowed us just to keep going. You know, we can make a life for ourselves and our families, and, you know, we don't have to quit to go find a real job that can actually pay the bills. And we've been lucky enough to like pay the bills with this. And there's a lot of bands out there that work just as hard as us, if not harder. We're just as talented as us that just didn't have, I think, that sort of component of luck that we had.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, it's funny to watch, right? When you see, I mean, I even saw it after you guys, you know, like, you become extremely successful and then every label tries to find their Jimmy Eat World, you know, and everyone's trying to figure out the formula. What is the formula? And like, it's just always this mixture of 100,000 variables that no A&R guy could ever recreate, you know, like you got to find these things that are just, it's impossible to recreate because it's so many elements put into one, right?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's such a big mistake, I think, to try and listen to a band that's doing well and then find something that's like, oh, well, let's find something that's just like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's the dumbest shit.
Because you're not, you know, at some point, I think this is sort of another maybe component of longevity is just being honest about who you are, trying to be true to yourselves and like not chasing some outcome, right? And I think we, for whatever reason, I think we learned and continue to kind of like stress that idea of, you know, we want to push ourselves, but at the same time, we want to try new things and do something that challenges us, but we don't want to chase something for the sake of chasing it. Right. And I think I think people can kind of hear that in the music sometimes, like when you're chasing it, it's not true to who you are. You're not being authentic and you come off as being forced. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we've always tried to avoid, and ride that line of still being us, but doing something we enjoy and appreciate, but then like pushing, you know, the limit a little bit here and there when we feel like musically it makes sense.
Right. Totally. Nah, and you mentioned Jim as far as, you know, his role in, you know, being a good artistic leader in the way that, you know, he allows everyone in, everybody has their space and he's not a dick about it. But I was wondering about you, you know, when, you know, the middle breaks and you guys are this, you know, massive band all around the world. Did you ever have to, it was a problem I had, so I'm projecting my own problems on you out of curiosity. Like, have you ever had to reconcile the idea that like the drummer is not recognized as much for the success of what's happening? Like, have you ever had to battle with staying level-headed and without getting as much credit for the things that are happening publicly? I know internally you were getting, you know, the credit you needed, but maybe externally, did you ever feel like a void there?
I've never struggled with that. I never worried about that or
it's awesome.
Worried about that. I mean, yeah, it's not something that I've really considered or even considering it, you know, it's just the way it is, you know, like,
right. Yeah.
If there's lots of bands that I love, you know, that I listen to on a weekly basis, that if their drummer walked past me on the sidewalk, I wouldn't have any fucking clue who he was.
Yeah.
You know,
for
so
sure.
It's part of it, you know? And I think that there's part of some, and to me, I've always sort of thought of it as like a benefit. Mm. You know, not like we're getting, you know, recognized all over the place, but like that rarely happens for me. And so, that definitely something that, you know, happens a lot more to Jim than it does to me. And so, right. You know, I see it as kind of like a benefit, you know?
Sure.
But yeah, it doesn't really leave a sour taste in my mouth at all.
That's awesome. You're obviously a more well-adjusted person than I am.
I think it has a lot to do with though, your relationship with your bandmates, you know? You know, and I think that that relationship is more important and more grounding than like what other people might think or say, because ultimately, like if you're a drummer and you want the same amount of credit from like Joe Blow, who's commenting on your YouTube videos, you know, like, you know, on your band site, like you're not going to get that. Right. But I think if you don't get it from your band or, you know, and that would be a much tougher pill to swallow.
Yeah, right. That makes perfect sense. Now, so the middle breaks, right? It's one of the biggest songs in the world, right, at that time. What's if you can recall, what's like the craziest Spinal Tap type thing that happened during that time? Like, what was like the biggest silly surprise of having a song that big?
Man, I think for us it was playing on SNL and like having Cameron Diaz come into like our dressing room and say hi, and we're like, wait, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
that was sort of like, and then just freaking out about like, man, this is really like the East Coast feed of this is really live, you know? And like, that was like nerve wracking. That was a very nerve wracking experience. I mean, I think that's sort of the moment that comes to mind. I think just being like the ages that we are growing up with SNL and that being such a big deal to us and the, like our age, like sort of our generation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that was definitely probably the moment we were like, whoa, this is sort of strange that we're here doing this.
That's awesome. Now, like, drum wise, you know, you've never really been a stranger to sampling even early on in Jimmy Eat World and adding that element. When did you adopt kind of getting into that sort of thing, and what bands were kind of lending you that way?
Like sampling, like just like in what way do you mean?
Like using a sampled sound in a song. You know, drastically changing the sound of the drums for, you know, a bridge going into the chorus, or like,
yeah,
you
sure.
seem to always have this real like body and a little bit of a, especially for the scene we came from, you know, like you guys were doing splits with Sensefield and Mineral and you know, bands like that who weren't going anywhere near stuff like that. So where was that coming from for you?
I think we've always tried to use kind of the studio as like an instrument, you know, and for us, sometimes musically it makes sense for things to not be performed. And so, I think it was like, you know, on Bleed American, we used a lot of samples, but they were always samples that we recorded ourselves. Right, so it was I don't think we've ever used like samples from some other source other than something we're tracking. Cause a lot of times we're trying to achieve a sound and then we use that sound in a loop. Mm-hmm. And we'll sample it. You know, we've done stuff with drum machines in the past. I mean, I think for us, it was just a combination of, it's probably a combination of trying to serve the song, or sometimes it's even getting a new toy and like, oh, this is cool. Like, can we write something on this? And then it's like, oh, that's a song, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, being open to that, not always thinking, oh, well, we can't do that because there's a, you know, a rule or whatever that, like, for us, it's always been about figuring out the best way to make the song, executing each song in a way that makes it have the most impact. And sometimes, you know, putting down the sticks and doing something different is necessary.
Yeah. Cool. Now, do you remember how you wrote the groove for Sweetness? That is one of my favorite grooves of all time. And I was wondering if you remember what the writing of that song was like.
So I don't even think I wrote that. I think Jim wrote that.
Oh, wow.
I think Jim wrote, like, you know how like guitar players sit down and play drums,
mm-hmm.
and it sounds like a guitar player is playing drums. It's weird.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, that's something that I've always like, Jim is not a great drummer, but he's a good enough drummer to come up with things that are kind of interesting.
Mm.
And I think my beat on that is a sort of translation of a demo, like Jim kind of doing a very chaotic version of that. So my beat is sort of like a cleaned up, nicer version of that, of Jim's sort of original idea. Cause we originally, were going to put that on Clarity.
Oh, okay.
And it was like one of those things where you have the album in the can, and then Jim had like this moment of like, you know, oh, hey, let's do this. But yeah, I mean, I don't think a lot of people know this, but Jim comes up with a lot of drum parts in Jimmy World, and it's a lot of it is like me kind of reinterpreting it, or me, sometimes I totally get rid of it and I do something completely different, but it's cool because he oftentimes will do something that would have never have occurred to me to do. Right. And I'd be like, oh, that's weird. And then it would like, I'm like, well, do I do it just like that? Or do I translate it a different way? And, or do I kind of alter it? Or so, that happens all the time. I have to do that stuff all the time.
Interesting.
But, there's even one song, there's a song on Invented, the title track of Invented, Jim played, a demo to, and it's a really slow song. And, it's kind of a slow bummer song, and but it like Jim played the drums to it on the demo, and there was like this really cool character of how he played them, and I was like, dude, we should keep. There's a the beginning of the song is really mellow, and then the end of the song kind of explodes into this really loud rock sound. So I was like, we should keep your drums for the first part, and then I'll just come in.
Oh, cool.
You know, and I think it's like in the bridge I come in, and it's like, I think it's really. Interesting because it's like sometimes, you know, when people who aren't drummers play drums, there's a kind of weird quality to it can creatively be almost a little bit more. I don't know. It's almost like it was like less assuming and almost hesitant. And I thought, man, that's a really good vibe for the beginning of the song. Let's keep it. So right. He actually plays drums on the final album. That's him playing.
That's awesome. I could see where that's helpful now that you mention it. Cause I listened to some things I wrote when I was younger. And I realize I'm like, well, it's a terribly wrong part. Everything about it is wrong, but it's cool. But all these years of, you know, cumulative experience writing songs mean I would never write this part on my own again. You know, like I've gotten too pro to like write something so weird, you know, and I could see where having that outside influence in that way could be.
It takes a lot of confidence to appreciate that, you know. I mean, that I think what that right there, that example gives me a lot of insight into kind of the question that Benny had before about you guys just staying together and not having an attitude about who's in the limelight, because that's the hardest thing to do is to recognize when that drum part that somebody else played and it's not perfect works, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think it's, I mean, I think for us, the mode is always what serves the song the best, what makes each song, you know, the best. And if that means I don't play on that part, then cool. You know, like that, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, like, there's a, you know, and it's giving each other space and trying to be like the best version of a band that you can be. And sometimes that means, you know, maybe you're not involved.
Right. You know,
I mean, it takes so much confidence to recognize that though. I applaud that. That's fantastic. You know, I mean, there's so many successful bands that are huge that still can't do that.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's true.
And you know, and it goes both ways, you know, like there was, we were, when we made our Integrity Blues album that we made, in 2016, we took 2015 off. So we literally didn't do anything Jimmy Eat World. And then we decided, hey, we're going to make a record and we're going to put it out. And our timeline was so short that Jim was like, hey, like I need some help. Like, so if you have any melody ideas, just lay them down, you know, like just throw them down. So there's a song on that album called Pretty Grids that Jim, I wrote the chorus melody to it. And so, and Jim actually used it, which I was fucking shocked that he used it.
That's awesome.
But I think he was like, I guess this works. I'll use it, you know? And I don't know if he was just sort of like, okay, I'm over this song and I just want to finish it. But right. It turned out really cool. But it's like, I sort of felt like that's my, you know, so it's sort of an example of him giving me the license to contribute in, you know, in his territory. And I think it's made easier by the fact that, like, you know, I'm not precious about, oh, well, I need to write the drum part or anything like that. That's funny. I get asked the question, like, hey, what about this drum beat? You know, like, I think someone asked me about the cautioners beat. And I was like, I think Jim came up with that. So, like, you know, it's just like, which is fine. You know, it's like, you know, to me, it's like, I'm going to take that, I'm going to execute it and figure out the coolest way to do it.
You know? Sure. Well, and also I think once you start respecting somebody as a songwriter, you know, it's like, what drums are you hearing in your head to execute the song as it's supposed to be, right? Like, you know, like, do you guys ever have discussions like that? Like, if it's not as demoed and there's not a drum part, do you ever just ask, like, what's the vibe here? Like, what do you want this song to feel like?
Yeah. So Jim will almost never come up with a demo that doesn't have some kind of like rhythmic component to it.
Okay.
So,
and usually he question, programs that stuff.
So he'll play it and then he beat detectives it. Oh, so wow. Like he'll, cool. He'll like play it on my kit in the studio and then he'll like arrange it kind of, and it's, you know, sometimes it sounds, he kind of makes it sound presentable.
Yeah, and he's a pretty advanced engineer, right?
Oh, he's super, super advanced.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he's a great engineer and a great producer. And like, yeah, he literally needs no help doing any of that stuff. That's cool. So, he'll do that. To me, the interesting moment where this becomes a problem for me is when he writes something that, you know, like it's like anything, like when you write an idea and you have like the first thing you kind of put down is the rhythm second, the rhythm part of the drums. And then you build on top of that. It's really hard to strip away that foundation and come up with something different that feels good. Right. And, but there are times where I'm like, you know, the part isn't good. The part doesn't make sense. And I need to change that, but I need to change it in a way that still fits with the overall vibe of the song.
Right.
And so, it's like that can sometimes be like, you're almost trying to put a puzzle piece into a puzzle that's like not quite fitting in. Right.
Yeah, sure.
And so that can be tricky and that can be creatively frustrating. But you know, more times than not, it's like I can just make some adjustments or, you know, and the cool thing about with Jim, it's like, and I've never, I can't imagine other songwriters are like this, but like Jim will show us an idea. And he'll put down the drums and he'll put down everything. It'll be like, okay, here's the song. And we'll say, or, you know, usually it's me. I'll say, we need to do this. And like, I have a totally radically different idea of what the song could be.
Right.
And Jim is just like, cool, let's try it. Like, he doesn't care. He's like, he'll totally be like, not precious with, you know, cause I think a lot of times in that situation, the songwriter would be like, well, you know, slow your roll, dude, you're just a drummer we're doing. And Jim will just be like, yeah, let's try it. Cool. And then we'll try it. And then it'll be like, oh, that didn't work, but there's something about that that's really cool. Let's try it this way, you know? And so it's like this really unique thing because, you know, when Jim writes a demo, he's so good at being a producer and envisioning layers and doing things that it's like, it's so intricate. And there's like, you listen to it and you think to yourself, I think to myself, man, so many decisions have been made here.
That
if we want to change it, we'll have to be unmade.
Right.
And Jim is just kind of like, over the years and, you know, we working together and making all these records with each other, he's like, okay, let's try something different.
Wow.
You know? And like, he doesn't,
he's not precious.
No, he's not precious with it. He doesn't say my way or the highway. So that's huge, you know? And I think because we're like that with each other and we allow this give and take and him from me and me from him and even the other guys and their ideas. It's a great way of leadership. It's a great way of like, he's sort of allowing himself to like remove himself and we can interact and be more of a part of it. And it just, it grounds everyone into being a part of the band in a way that like is, I think, more meaningful. Right. And so when things come up, like disagreements or whatever, it's just not, doesn't feel like a big, that big of a deal, because we like, we're all on the same team. We're all trying to get the song to be the best it can be, or we're all trying to get the tour to look and sound the best it can sound and, you know, be. And we, I think that just inherent vibe is there.
Man, you desert people are so relaxed.
we gotta reserve our energy, man.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I'm terribly jealous.
I'm not. I mean, all of this makes a lot. You know, the question I asked the most like 30 minutes ago. Like, it all makes sense now.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like how. You know, it took a while to get there, but we have exactly answered the question I asked on how Jimmy Eat World pulls it off. It's like right. Pretty obvious, which is great. So here is where I just get bored about songwriting, you know, because who cares, sure. Right? This is a segment of the program, and I can't wait to do this one because Brad here is an IPA snob just like you, Zach.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So maybe you guys can go off on a little tangent after this. But this is a section of the program we call Mystery Friend.
Who did you piss on? Who did you offend? Were you late to the gig? Did you show up at the end? Put on your thinking caps. It's your mystery friend.
Now, the point of this.
Okay.
Yeah, the point of this is I got a story from a mystery friend of yours. Okay. I'd like you to tell me about the story and then guess which mystery friend told me.
Okay, yeah, I can do that. That's fun.
Okay, so apparently, again, you're a big IPA drinker and you don't prefer a cheaper ale, especially on tour. And I heard about a time that a bus that was on one of your tours banned IPAs. And IPAs were not allowed on the bus. And something happened where you were told that you couldn't go on, and then somehow still bullied your way in as a member of the band.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm not going to let that stop me, man.
So what's the story there? So you were banned from your own crew bus?
I might have been banned from my own crew bus, but I don't think it was like... I mean, at least I didn't take it as like them being actually serious, and I didn't really... I mean, as you can tell by the story, I didn't really honor that. man, who would that be?
You need to elaborate a little bit on this story.
Yeah, so what's the story?
Fill in some color. Give us some color.
Well, I think here's where the frustration is. For the most part, when we're on tour, we're all like on the same bus. So we will travel with our band, with our crew on the same bus. So that's like 11 people sometimes mm-hmm. on a 12 bunk bus. And, you know, there are limited spaces in the coolers, you know, to have both a large variety of IPAs, and the crew prefers more kind of like, you know, they're happy, which is if it's Tecate, they're like, that's fine.
Yeah. Right.
I just don't like, you know, not that I don't even care like how expensive or not expensive the beer is. I just don't really like pilsners or lagers all that much. Occasionally, like if it's really hot outside and, you know, it's like on ice and it's refreshing, then cool. I'm down with that. But like for the most part, I stick to sort of IPAs and just hoppier beers.
Okay.
So I think that when you have, and I'm probably the person in the band that drinks more beer than anyone else in the band. Okay. Maybe me and Rick.
So you got to kind of dictate the beer that's around when you're the biggest drinker. Yeah.
A little bit. But Rick, you know, also kind of, he's more of a variety. He enjoys kind of like all different beer varieties. So, and when we travel separately, the crew will order their own beer and I will, you know, we have just our own beer on our bus and it's just kind of different. So like the worlds are no longer, the world no longer collide, but I think that there's maybe some animosity from the crew and being limited in their space when we're together, that I think when they don't have that limitation, they like to kind of rub my nose into it. But the reality of it is like, I'm happy that they have the kind of beer that they like. I don't have anything against that. And I don't know why I would need to be banned. Like, you know, I'm not trying to dictate what they can and can't drink. I'm just, you know, like I can understand, like, when you're in a tight space with a lot of people and you don't get the kind of, you know, selection that you like, then, you know, that's kind of a drag.
Well, I can see where this comes together now, because the story I was told was referring to when you were opening for Incubus. So I'm sure you had a little bit more cash floating around that tour and maybe added a crew bus. So I think they may have been getting back at you, it sounds, maybe by filling up the coolers with too many IPAs. Once they had their own space, they're like, no IPAs. You're not allowed on anymore. But the person who told me this, and I quote, said, Zach pushed his way past and starts questioning our rule, and I was quickly thrown under the bus as the one who made the rule. Zach basically said, you can't enforce this rule on me. I'm technically your boss and paying for this bus.
I probably did say all of that.
This was in a friendly way, apparently, not a negative way.
Yeah.
And then they let you on the bus with, and I quote, your gross IPA.
Yeah.
So
I probably said all of that in a very joking manner. Yeah. Like I would threaten that all the time. Like, hey, listen, you work for me, asshole. Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. Don't step to me.
It was noted to me in the email that was a jovial part of it, not a serious.
That's good.
Part
that's
of
good.
It. Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad they took it that way. I think everyone at a certain point in time, and like, I think sometimes people who don't know me as well, don't really like sometimes don't know that I'm joking. And my wife tells me this all the time. Is like, I'll say a joke and I'll be totally joking.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think she like whispered to me like, I don't think they think you're joking.
Yeah. Cause
like the way I say it is not necessarily, I'm acting like I'm really saying it, but I'm not.
But
I'm glad that it was received in the way that it was meant. And I literally have no idea. I can try and guess, man, who was on that tour that you would know? I'm not sure. I don't know. I have no idea who that is.
All right. Well, give me one guess who would be the bus captain of the crew bus.
The bus captain of the crew bus.
And I'll give you this hint too. I got an email from a name that I was very blown away by. It's not this person's real name.
Oh, man.
All right, it's fine. I got an email from a man named Thorns Capricorn.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thorns. That makes sense.
Which is apparently a real name. Thorns Capricorn.
I got the email as. He's our merch guy. And okay. I think him being the captain of the crew bus is very generous.
Thorns, you lied to me.
but it's but that does make sense, because I think Thorns, that makes sense. That makes sense to me now. That makes a lot of sense. Thorns is an awesome dude.
Yeah,
I love Thorns.
He's cool.
A very, very cool guy and a very hard worker. And that's funny. That's cool.
And I don't actually know Thorns. I went through a friend of a friend to try to get your mystery friend. I did a little work.
That's good, because I was trying to think like, who would know you?
Yeah,
but Thorns makes sense, because he's a New York guy.
Oh, okay, that does make sense. Now this leads back to a long-standing argument we've been having on this program, me and Brad here. Now Brad a while ago told me that if I showed up to his house with a sixer, like, hey buddy, I need to hang out, let's have a drink, you know, and I showed up with a sixer of beer, that he would deny my beer and go to the fridge and grab one of his IPAs, which I just find really offensive. What's your opinion on that?
So you're bringing over a beer for Brad to enjoy.
I'm bringing over a six pack. Like, hey, I'm your buddy. I showed up at your house. I need to have a couple beers with someone, you know?
Right.
I feel it's insulting to be like, oh, no, save your beer. I'm going to go get my fancy one from the fridge.
I don't think that's insulting at all. Personally, I mean,
so you do the same.
I would do the exact same.
See, I told Benny, so yeah, I'm a dad now, and I'm also older probably than both of you guys. And
it's true.
You know, I don't. Yeah, there was a time when I could put away like 2 6-packs and pretty much, you know, function. But nowadays it's more like, you know, 2 beers a night. So I need to, you know, I need to ration, and I don't want to, I don't want to fill that space with an inferior product.
Yeah. It's, I think that's the, what you're referring to, I think, is the idea that life is too short to drink shitty beer. And if, you know, I would say it's insulting that you're coming over to someone's house and you're not, you're knowingly bringing them beer that you know they won't like.
Wow. It's on me now.
Yeah, it's on you. Like, you should know your bro. You should know your bud. Like, hey, if I have a friend like that, you know, doesn't like stouts, I'm not going to bring over a bunch of stouts for him to like drink while we hang out.
Wow, teamed up on by a couple IPA snobs. This is rough. This is rough.
Sorry, Benny.
But I do think like it's, you know, like for me, I have I have the beer that I drink. I also have beer at my home that I don't drink, and it's saved precisely for that moment where people come over.
Right.
Okay, here you go. You can have my garbage beer that I keep in the fridge in the backyard, and then I'll have the good stuff.
Stock beer.
So Zach, let me ask you something, because this is, I started to notice this right about the time that my, my cousin, who's definitely a Pilsner drinker of the, American variety, had said, you know, I like an IPA, but you know, you got to be careful because it's hard to go back. And I thought about that because I was having that. I was realizing that, you know, that, yeah, I couldn't go back from, you get used to all that flavor. And then even beers that I really enjoyed, you know, like an ale or something was just not enough.
It's true. Like I remember when I first kind of started drinking beer, I really kind of, like, I sort of dug like more amber red ales.
Uh-huh.
And, I can't do them. Like I don't like those. I'd rather drink like a Coors Light than like some amber ale.
Yeah. Yeah. Those,
it's weird.
It can happen with coffee, you know, like I think maybe Starbucks ruined me for, you know, I can't get a deli coffee, dude. Cause like, it doesn't have enough flavor. It's kind of the same vibe.
I don't know. Maybe it's just how I was raised as a bottom feeder, but I'll drink shitty coffee, good coffee, shitty beer, good beer. It's just, it's, you know, I'd prefer the good one, but if the other one's around, yeah, you know,
well, your life will definitely be easier, Benny.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a blessing, man. Like I'd take that and run with it. You know, I mean, you know, listen, all beer is basically kind of a pretty similar price. Like if you want to like, yeah, if you want to get the Bud and the Bud Light, but like, do you tell a difference between like, you know, like would you, like if you, so someone had like a Bud Light and then they had like a local brewery that's actually making like a Pilsner or, a lager or something like that, would you go for would you on purpose go for like the Bud Light, or would you go for the nicer, maybe well made product?
I would 1000% go for the well made product. That, I mean, that's the thing about this argument. I'm not going to sit here and make the argument that Bud Light isn't piss. Bud Light is piss. It's cold beer piss. You know what I mean? And it's barely good, but I'd still drink it. If it's the only thing around, and if my friend,
oh, don't get me wrong, it, you know? Dude, I would drink it if it was the only thing around.
See, I don't know if I like if I was like if I go to a place like, you know, like for instance, like let's say a good example, like I sometimes go golfing, and like, you know, the person with the cart comes around and like, hey, do you have any IPAs? And they'll be like, no, but I have like some, you know, Bud Light, I have some Heineken, I have this, that. I'm like, I'm like, nope, I'm good.
Wow. Like, oh, you pass. Hard pass.
I pass.
A cold beer in the hot desert playing golf and you pass. Wow.
Yeah, I pass. I'd rather just have like a water or something like that.
Shocking. Shocking news to me. Now, speaking of the desert, there's one interesting thing about Mesa that I learned that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about. Now, I didn't realize, you know, obviously there's a deep, rich history with Native Americans in your area. And apparently Mesa had the largest and most sophisticated canals in the prehistoric world that still exist in the city. And apparently water could be delivered to over 110,000 acres in the Sonoran Desert, creating an agricultural oasis. Is there any remnants of that still left around?
Yeah, I don't know if there are any remnants of like the original canals, but I would imagine that because we do have like a canal system that goes through the entire metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, there's kind of like a sort of grid of canals that goes through the whole area. And so it's possible that some of that canal system was used to, you know, sort of base it on the newer version of it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean,
from what I read, it is those canals that exist in Mesa are still some of the pre-existing canals from, or I mean, at least the, you know, based on the original structures. And the thing I wanted to finish on, you know, this is the last episode of the year. We'll be releasing on New Year's Eve. And we just relaunched this year. So you're standing on hallowed ground at the moment.
Oh, Zach. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
But so I wanted to see what's your prediction or outlook for 2021? What do you see for yourself? What do you see for the band and maybe our ever-growing morbid reality?
Yeah. You know, I think that for myself, I guess as whenever I talk about myself, it's kind of interrelated to the band as well.
Sure.
You know, I think we're going to really try to focus on writing some new material.
Okay.
And do some of that. And then, you know, I'm really hoping by like the end of the year, there's going to be some signs of life on the touring front. But, you know, I guess we'll just wait and see how it plays out and see if it's safe and people feel comfortable enough to go to shows. But it would be great if there's some sort of signs of life there.
Yeah. And what about for you personally? What are you looking forward to this year? Any big goals?
I haven't thought about it, to be honest. Really haven't thought about like personal goals. I guess I should start thinking about that right now.
Well,
I think just like, you know, like, maybe, it would be, you know, I'm kind of excited for the kids to be able to play sports, a little bit more freely and more often. That would be nice. I'm a father of two boys, so that would be fun. Yeah. And then, you know, just like, I don't know, man, maybe lose a few pounds, you know, maybe drink, you know, a little less coffee. I don't know. Sure. Maybe I need to start thinking about that.
I love that. Well, looks like the Phoenix Suns might make the playoffs this year. So have fun with that.
Let's hope. Let's hope, yeah, man.
Looking like it. All right, Zach. Well, thanks again, man. I really appreciate you doing this.
My pleasure, man. Take care.
Thanks, Zach.
Awesome. Be good.
All right.
Well, look at that. Another IPA stop.
Yeah. Thank you.
Just
for
like
that.
You.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Zach.
Now I'm feeling like trashy. You know, you guys are making me feel trashy. If I show up to either of your houses with a six pack of Corona, I'm going to get hey, thrown under the bus.
I'll drink a cold Corona in the summertime. That's not a problem.
See, that's my vibe. I mean, we keep talking about this with IPAs. It's like I have a very specific need for beer, right? I'm a Scotch drinker.
Right.
So like when I'm trying to get, you know, I came from a drug world, not alcohol, right? so like alcohol to me, beer just takes way too long. I need nearly instantaneous results. So I'm usually having a Scotch, you know?
Right.
And the only time I really feel like a beer is when I'm thirsty.
Right.
it's when I want like a cold beer, refreshing beer.
Yeah, I get
so the
it.
Idea of like a IPA milk stout coffee something or other, you know, no, what no. I mean, in the middle of that, I'm like, you know, that's like the last thing I want to taste right now.
All right, next time we get together, I'll give you, there's a variety of IPAs. I'm really into this one that comes from Brooklyn now called Tiny Juicy IPA, and it's like,
I like the name.
It's kind of a thirst quencher. It's kind of like almost like a cider IPA. It's really tasty.
All right, maybe you can sell me. So
I'll hook you up.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
We've been doing these interviews for a while, right? And I'm always fascinated by bands like Jimmy Eat World because, you know, being in a band is like this bizarre anthropological, sociological, like experiment, even psychological experiment.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Definitely
like
is.
There's so many levels to it in that way. And there are so few people in the world who could even understand like being stuck in this small of a group and being forced to make decisions with each other for so long. Like seriously, the only other people who have to do shit like this are like flight attendants and pilots and then like military people. Like it's a very select group. So when I see someone like a band that's just 20 years of the same people, not an ounce of chatter, you know, outside of the band, like there's problems.
Right.
You know, like obviously like this mutual respect. I really am fascinated. I'm like, how does this happen? You know what I mean? And I want to collect as much information about that as possible, because I think it's like useful knowledge for people going forward and trying to like do these bands.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. And I think that was a great question. I think I told you this, but you know, when I was in the Goops, we went to therapy. We went to a therapy session right. altogether. Yeah. And it was because the communication had just completely broken down. And like, I don't think that was a band where I was going to be playing any drum parts in. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's just that degree of confidence just stuns me. But also it makes me realize that, yeah, that's what it is that those guys, their confidence levels are higher than their ego levels. That's right. The only way to explain it. So like,
but they give that to each other.
Yeah, but it's interesting and as important as it is for bands to learn like these secrets to success, like that's not going to help anyone because that's a personality type. Like these guys.
Yeah, right.
You know
right.
what I mean? Like that
yeah, it
one
takes a certain.
Yeah, that takes a certain type of person that like you could just hear it in the way he answered the questions. Like he just like when you asked him about being the drummer and being. You know, the kind of the background guy he was.
I felt like such a fucking idiot.
No, but like it's totally natural to feel that way. 98% of the people in the world are going to feel the way you do, man. And
I was like, yo, I am weak.
The fact that he couldn't, it almost is as though he couldn't identify with the question, which
yeah,
I was.
Yeah, right. I know. Amazing. Yeah. It was interesting.
Yeah. That's,
it lends me to another thing though, is like, can you think of an example of like a Jimmy Eat World type of scenario from people who are from our area?
No.
Like people from the tri-state area. Seriously, is there a band that like came out of the tri-state area?
I feel like the Souls, maybe. They're the only band that I can think of that I've never witnessed like, you know, major internal sort of strife.
They've had a few drummers though.
Right.
They're on their third drummer.
Right.
But right. That is a pretty good example because those guys are family.
Yeah.
And that is family style.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Menzingers. Menzingers are from around here. They're pretty close to that. From our world, you know, this is where I'm drawing from. But it's like, I don't know. And I know, like, you know, maybe there is something. Like, you take four people from broken homes. Your whole example of, like, dealing with conflict.
Yeah.
Like there's a way out of conflict when you come from a broken home. Like there's always like, I dealt with it in relationships. Like my whole, like coming from a divorced family, you know, in your head, sure. It's always an option.
No, I think that,
you know, you can always just split. So if you have like that, you know, at least that base there, it could play a role too.
No, I think that observation was way more on point than what he acknowledged. I think you were right on with that because because when when you come from a place where people have learned to resolve issues among each other, you learn how to do it, I think. And it's, and it's even more so when you don't come from that place, when you're like, okay, the way to avoid conflict is just to leave.
Right.
You know, and I'm not to say that, like, you know, it's, I'm not trying to be judgmental of quote unquote broken homes, because, you know, we all, I mean, I do, I come from divorced parents, and
yes, we both do, Brad.
Yeah. So it's like, and it was, there was, you know, and it was amazingly healthy environment. Like in my case, like,
right.
My parents are friends to this day. They sometimes get together for holidays and stuff, but, yeah, I think that really has more to do with it than maybe he had acknowledged, because that's all he knows, you know, like he doesn't.
Right.
So I don't think he recognized that that could have as much impact on it as it did.
And maybe it's even less being about like the ability to resolve issues, because like anyone could adapt into that. But maybe more living through issues.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like watching people like have issues, but not going anywhere,
right?
You know, like you have no choice but to resolve them if nobody's gonna leave,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't know, so we got into some interesting stuff. Good interview, good dude. Zach has his own podcast now, talking about Phoenix area sports.
Yeah, burn in hell.
Yeah, burn in hell, man.
So if you're like interested in Arizona sports teams, check it out.
It's a good time to jump on to the Phoenix Suns bandwagon. I predicted them to make the playoffs this season, so good time to jump on the Suns bandwagon.
I mean, maybe you want to get there via his podcast. His socials are Burnin' Hell AZ, and yeah, it's the Burnin' Hell podcast. And Zach's personal socials are at Zlind76, at Zlind76. And I think you can find Jimmy World social on
Yeah, maybe you've heard of his group. A big group.
Oh, and big shout out this week to Tyler, who is our big benefactor of the week on Venmo. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what he gave, but hey, it's a healthy two figures, okay?
Like
it's
that.
A big tip, my friend.
It's three fingers of Glenn Livett. Let's just say that.
At least.
Yeah. So yeah, appreciate that. We have the Patreon. Oh, and we're setting up the chat, right? This
Hopefully
week?
We're gonna have a holiday chat. So our patrons have been invited. If you are a patron, keep an eye out for a message. Hopefully we'll have Benny and me in a little chat. Maybe we'll do like New Year's Day or something. I don't know. When is a good time?
I'll give you all the story of Hanukkah.
There you go. We'll try to get that done before the weekend's over. Anybody who's interested in that, patreon.com/goingofftrack. You know, if you don't know what Patreon is, just go check it out. You can figure it out.
Yeah.
If you want to throw us a little tip, if you want to throw us a huge tip like Tyler did, or a little tip, we're happy with all of it. Go to venmo.com/offtrack. Offtrack is the username at Venmo, and we appreciate all of it. And we'll also just take a good review on iTunes, because, you know,
yeah,
that's cool too.
Sexually explicit, please. No one wrote one. I'm very disappointed.
Or if you really love us and you just have nothing but time and no money, you can build Benny a Wikipedia page. Right.
That is the ultimate version of altruism in this case. I'd also like to finish this week, a bit of a somber note, but rest in peace to a guy named Pat Harrington, who's a young guy, a surfer who lived in Long Beach Island, who I met through Mercy Union. I texted with him a little. He fought cancer for years. He's a very inspiring guy. He went through the whole thing super courageously, with a lot of humility, and just before Christmas passed away. So I want to give a shout out to Pat Harrington and his family.
Happy New Year for the rest of it.
Everyone enjoy. Kiss your people.
Yeah.
Love y'all.
Yeah! Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.